the ideas, the leaders, the lives that are shaping Denmark and the world. From Blocks Hub in Copenhagen, Denmark, with your co-hosts, Ed Lay and Thomas Mulhern, this is Global Denmark.
Hello and welcome back to the Global Denmark podcast, where we explore how thought leaders and innovators are working to create a better Denmark and a better world. Well, we're back from the summer holiday, refreshed, recharged, ready to go. And we recently had the pleasure of sitting down with Mike Viking, or Viking, as us internationals like to call him. Mike is the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute. He's also a New York Times bestselling author and has written several books and reports on happiness, subjective well-being, and quality of life, including his bestsellers Hygge and Lykke. His books have sold over 1 million copies worldwide. Previously, Mike has also worked for the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs and was the director for the think tank Monday Morning. In this wide-ranging conversation, we explored a variety of subjects, including what is Hygge and Lykke, the dark side of Hygge, the World Happiness Report data and dimensions of happiness, and finally, how can countries put happiness on the agenda going forward? Without further ado, we bring you Mike Viking. We are back. I am here, as always, with my co-host, Ed Lay. Ed, how you doing?
Happy, Thomas.
I am also happy to be here and feeling very hygge. Well, that's done. Because our guest today is none other than Mike Viking, or Viking, as the international crowd calls you. Mike, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
How you doing today?
I'm doing well. So I've went to the studio this morning to narrate my upcoming book, which is always fun and a learningful experience, because I discover I've been mispronouncing tomatoes for years or something like that. So it's been good.
That's because they're tomatoes.
That's what I would. That is what I would say.
Let's pull the whole thing off.
Well, tomatoes aside, I want to dive right in. Perhaps you could define for our audience Hygge and Lykke.
Right. So Hygge, I think the best short definition is the art of creating a nice atmosphere. And Lykke is just the Danish word for happiness.
The art of creating a nice atmosphere. You know, we talk about it with people all the time. They say, hey, look, you cannot translate Hygge to cozy. So are you saying that cozy is not equivalent to a nice atmosphere, or what is it that distinguishes?
I think if you want to use the word cozy, you need to add the word consciously to it. So I think hygge is being consciously cozy. I think it has a conscious element to it. I also think there are other words in other languages that comes close to hygge. Cozy might be one of them. In German, they also have gesellig. No, that's the Dutch one. In Germany, they have gemütlichkeit. And I think both of those words are actually close to what we talk about when we talk about hygge in Danish. And I think, you know, Danes like to say, hygge only happens in Denmark. I don't think that's the case. I don't think Denmark has a monopoly on hygge. I've been having very hyggely times in the UK. I've been having very hyggely times in the US. But I think what is uniquely Danish is we have a word that describes that situation. I think that is perhaps uniquely Danish. What is also uniquely Danish is how much value we give to the concept and how we see hygge as part of the national culture and the national DNA, the same way that perhaps in the US, Americans see freedom as something inherently American. Danes would see hygge as something inherently Danish, but it happens everywhere. And that's also what I hear from readers writing me. I've been having hygge all my life, they say. I just didn't know there was a word for it. But of course, hygge happens everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, something that I notice from being here in Denmark and having spent a lot of time here is that because of this word, perhaps, when I go to a birthday party or something like that, much more effort is put into it to perhaps create that situation rather than it's a birthday, it's we're trying to create this public experience around it. Much like in America, they talk about freedom a lot, but don't really have it.
On contrary.
How do you think hygge extends to people coming in to Denmark?
I think there is actually a dark side to hygge in that sense. I think a lot of Danes will consider an evening where they know everyone more hyggelig than if there are newcomers in the group. Because hygge is this feeling of feeling relaxed, being able to let your guard down. And if there is somebody you don't know in the group, whether they are Danish or non-Danish, you are perhaps not as comfortable. And unfortunately, I think that can actually be sort of a barrier for expats coming to Denmark. Listen, we're having people over, we're having a dinner party, should we invite Ed? I don't know. I mean, he doesn't really know Charlotte and Benjamin. Maybe another time, because we really want to get back to what we talked about the last time Suzanne was going through that difficult thing at work, and maybe she's not comfortable with Ed being there and sort of opening up when she doesn't know him that well. So I think it can actually be a barrier in terms of opening up social circles. I think it's also something that Danes experience. I moved from Haderslev, in the southern part of Denmark to Copenhagen 20 years ago. And it also took me a long time to penetrate social circles in Denmark. And I hear that again and again from Danes and my international friends, that it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of patience to penetrate social circles in Denmark. So I think that's actually part of the dark side of hygge.
So it sounds like that for Danes in general, that psychological safety is a precondition for creating hygge.
I think so.
And coming out of your comfort zone
right.
Kind of would eliminate the possibility of having a hygge off.
Yeah. I don't think Danes would see sort of a high-powered, energetic event with loud music, and now, you know, we have to talk with everybody for about 2 minutes and then shift and talk with the next person for 2 minutes. I don't think Danes would see that necessarily as a hyggelig evening. Mm-hmm. I think Danes see hygge as something that happens in a smaller circle with people we know quite well.
If we showed Danes 100 pictures of different scenes taking place, how much in agreement do you think they would be if it's hyggelig or not hyggelig?
I think there would be more agreement to what is hyggelig or not hyggelig than if you showed 100 pictures and asked of art and said, what is great art? I think there is more consensus there than in a lot of the other areas, actually.
So Denmark is the happiest country in the world, or one of the happiest countries in the world. Could you give us some insight to perhaps what the data is on that? How is that actually being decided?
Right. So it is, what you're referring to there is probably the World Happiness Report.
Sure.
That have been coming out since 2012. And the World Happiness Report, it's commissioned by the UN. It's published by Earth Institute at Columbia University. And the data that goes into it is collected by Gallup. So Gallup World Poll. And I think it's important when we talk about happiness, it's important to highlight that happiness is a wide umbrella term. So we read different things into it. So Ed has one idea of what happiness is. Thomas has another one. I have a third. So we need to break it down and look at different dimensions or different components.
Sure.
The same way if we talked about how's the Danish economy doing, we also break that down to inflation, growth, GDP per capita, and so on. And that gives us a language to talk about how's the Danish economy doing. So with happiness, we break it down often into three dimensions. One of them is life satisfaction. So people are asked directly how happy they are with their life overall, or imagine a ladder with steps from 0 to 10. And on the 10th step, there is the best possible life you could live. on step zero. It's the worst possible life you could live. Where do you feel you stand right now? That's one dimension of happiness. It's also the dimension that goes into the World Happiness Report.
Satisfaction with the way things are going in life.
Yeah. And satisfaction with life in general. Yeah. So that's one dimension of happiness where we sort of take a step back and look at our lives. Yeah. Another dimension is called the affective dimension. And here we measure which mood are people in on a daily basis. And that is much more volatile than the first one. So on the second dimension, we can actually see there's a weekend effect on that one. People are happier on the Fridays than they are on Mondays and Tuesdays. Of course, the two dimensions are also linked, because if you have a lot of everydays with a lot of positive emotions, you also report higher levels of life satisfaction. But we can all have lousy mornings and still feel happy about our life overall. So the third dimension that OECD recommends that you include in surveys is the eudaimonic dimension. And that builds on Aristotle's perception of happiness or the good life. And he thought the good life is the meaningful life. So there you look at whether people have a sense of purpose in life. So you have three dimensions of happiness. The World Happiness Report only looks at, or primarily looks at, the first one. So overall life satisfaction. And there Gallup collects data from around 155 countries and then calculate a national average. And the Nordic countries, so Denmark, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Iceland, together with Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Switzerland, the Netherlands, always do well. So they are usually in the top 10. And in the other end of the spectrum, you have countries like Syria, Afghanistan, Central African Republic. So it's important to remember with these indexes, it's one dimension of happiness and it's a national average. So I mean, the media loves to call the Scandinavian countries or the Nordic countries the happiest countries in the world. Perhaps it's more adequate or a better label to call them the least unhappy countries, right? Because I think what the Nordic model...
That's not as good as the branding technique, I don't think.
But I think
it would go well with Jendelo and being modest.
But I also think, I mean, I think that is what is actually happening here. I think the Nordic model is really good at reducing causes for unhappiness. The Nordic countries, there's access to healthcare, there's access to university education, there's access to social security if you lose your job. So a lot of the things that brings misery and unhappiness for people around the world are reduced or eliminated. That brings up the bottom, that brings up the average, and that's why these countries come out on top.
I think it's really interesting you unpack it like that, because, you know, a lot of I work a lot with expatriates or repatriates coming back, and I think they're a lot of the time sold on this idea of the happiest country, not the least unhappy country. And they're thinking about it maybe in the Aristotelian sense of a, you know, all the goods being met, or even the effective sense, like you said, that why am I not being greeted with high fives and everyone's just laughing? And I think this confusing the different dimensions has a big effect on people.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we had some MIT students in, and one of the things that they noticed was that when they read happiest country in the world, they expected high fives and dancing everywhere, and weren't quite greeted with that.
Yeah, and actually in my last book, The Little Book of Lykke, I joke a little bit about this myth of Denmark, because nobody can live up to the expectations that have been created in the media. So I write that, you know, in Copenhagen, you know, free Lego is handed out in the streets and people leave offices at noon and everything is great. But 5 years ago, something did happen. There was a train that arrived late, about 2 minutes, but the passengers got a letter of apology from the prime minister and a designer chair of their choice. So I joked about it. I thought it was an obvious joke, but there was actually a journalist, now several journalists, but one of them was from the New York Times, who wrote me, did that really happen, or was it a joke?
No, and it was 3 minutes late.
I know. I wrote back, of course it was a joke. Our trains are never late.
I read once that the way that you can separate the British people and the American people inside a party is to run in and yell, "There's a purple giraffe in the garden," and all the Americans will run to the window. they spot the opportunities and they take opportunities because they're willing to go to the window. But some of them hadn't even crossed their mind that there wouldn't be a purple giraffe in the garden.
Right.
Now, in this model, do you...
Yourself not included, Tom.
Yeah. Do you equate happiness and well-being as the same concept?
I think they're overlapping. I mean, there is a lot of discussion in terms of how they overlap. Well-being, happiness, quality of life, joy. I think the best definitions of happiness is a super wide definition that encompasses well-being and joy, a sense of purpose. But then it's important when we look at the studies, break things down and look at different elements. But coming back to the whole, can people move here, experience happiness or a high level of happiness? So I think that we can look at it from different perspectives. So if we look at the data in the World Happiness Report, so the 2016 edition of the World Happiness Report looked at, as usual, the national average of happiness in different countries, but also looked at average happiness levels for foreign-born citizens in those countries. So you guys, for example, in Denmark.
Because that was a question. Who's
right?
actually filling out this data? Is it only citizens? Is it residents of the country?
Yeah, so that has actually changed. So, for instance, in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, it used to be only nationals, so the Emirati population, which is about 15% of the overall population. The rest of us, the rest of them are people like us or migrant workers from India and Bangladesh and so on. And it changed the way they collected data from being only nationals to being citizens. And that meant that the average happiness levels dropped in the UAE. In Denmark, it's Gallup that collects data. So it's me, but it's also you guys that is being collected. So it's not just Danish-born people. It's also
residents,
foreign-born people in Denmark. But the overall picture in the World Happiness Report in that chapter was the happier country, the happier the immigrants in that country as well. So if you developed a ranking, and they did that in the World Happiness Report, of foreign-born people in different countries, you would see the same outcome. So people in the happier countries are also foreign-born in Denmark would also be happier than foreign-born in
Syria.
That's given. Yeah. But also further up, sort of in the middle of the list. They could also show that people, when they move to one country, yes, they adopt some of the happiness levels from that country, but there's also a footprint from the original country. So if you're moving from a less happy country to the UK, you will merge towards the level in the UK over time. That means that if a person from Vietnam moved to Canada instead of the UK, that person, because Canada is high up in the ranking, they would adopt to a higher level in happiness over time. There is a chapter on it in the, I think it's the 2016 World Happiness
Report. So then you could make the claim that if you move to Denmark from a country that's ranked lower, that on average your general life satisfaction should increase.
According to the World Happiness Report, when you look across the different countries. Now, the question is, because that's an average, right? So the question is that also the case in Denmark? I think for some it would be the case, because people can enjoy some of the things that do make Danes happy. Access to healthcare, great infrastructure, access to education, low level of pollution. But, I think there are also challenges in Denmark that especially foreigners would face. For example, social isolation. I think that would probably be a bigger deal in Denmark for foreign-borns than if people moved to Canada or the US, for instance. So on average, when we look across the spectrum of countries, yes, if you move from a sadder country to a happier country, you will become happier. But of course, every case is unique. And this was across the spectrum of countries. So moving from one country to Denmark, I think, depends very much on the individual.
So we touch on the stress, depression, suicide levels in Denmark, which seem to not quite correlate with the happiest or least unhappy country, and where that kind of all fits into
right.
the puzzle.
Yeah, it's good because to bring it up, because there's a lot of myths around this. So a lot of people think that Denmark has a really high suicide rate.
Yeah.
We actually don't. So if you look globally, Denmark is in place 106. The highest suicide rate is in Sri Lanka. It's in countries like South Korea, Hungary, Lithuania. But the reason why people think we have a high suicide rate in Denmark is that we used to have a really high suicide rate. Mm-hmm. So in 1980, the suicide rate in Denmark per 100,000 was around 40, which was actually, I think, the highest in the world for women. Now, since 1980, fortunately, that has dropped to a quarter of that. So now it's around 9, 10, 11 per 100,000.
Okay. What have they done?
Well, several things. So they, of course, have better treatment today, both in terms of access to suicide hotlines, antidepressants, but also eliminated some of the causes that people were using. So earlier, you could go into a pharmacy and buy 300 pills. Right. Now there is a cap on how many pills you can buy at a time. And because suicide is often a spontaneous action, then if you're at home with 300 pills instead of 30 pills, your chance of so-called success is higher. So removing toxins in the gas that goes into the stoves and the different tools that people were using, reducing those have also meant reducing suicide levels. But also, I think, importantly, is normalizing the conversation around mental health, reducing the stigma around seeking out help, talking with your friends when you're struggling with life. I think those are some of the reasons. But fortunately, suicide rates have been reduced. They are below OECD average today. But that brings us to antidepressants,
yeah.
which a lot of people also think, they're happy because they use a lot of antidepressants.
In Denmark, they're sometimes referred to as leukapiller.
Leukapiller, yeah. Which is a bad label.
Yeah.
But yeah, antidepressants. So if you look at OECD data, I think the latest data available shows 18 countries, I believe, where Denmark is in eighth place in terms of consumption of antidepressants. So in the top, you'll have countries like Iceland, Australia, I forget the order of the ranking, but then Sweden, UK, Belgium, Portugal, Canada, I think, and then Denmark.
But the top?
The top, yeah. So Denmark is in eighth place. So yeah, we have sort of medium to the upper end of the consumption of antidepressants. But I think it's really important also to look at the bottom end of the scale. So which countries are not using antidepressants? And here you see South Korea and Hungary being second and third from the bottom. South Korea has the highest suicide rate in the OECD countries. Exactly. So the important thing here is, are people in South Korea then not depressed? They probably are, but they are not seeking treatment.
Right.
So of course it's not good necessarily to be a country with a high level of consumption of antidepressants like Iceland, but it's better to be a country that provides treatment, makes it affordable, and also reduce the stigma around seeking help. So there is a huge stigma around mental illness in South Korea that means that people are not seeking treatment. So there are so many nuances in this, but you know, a lot of people would like to say, Denmark, you can't be the happiest because you use a lot of antidepressants. And of course, that's a better story, especially if you're working in media, than going into the complexity of these fields.
What are some of the ingredients in that complexity? I mean, are there some countries that are just major outliers in that equation?
A country like South Korea is. There is a tremendous amount of pressure on people in South Korea. for people in general and for young people in particular due to their very competitive education system. You will also see patterns that in the former East Bloc, so Soviet, former Soviet countries, you will also see higher levels of suicide rates in those. You will also see a relationship between gun ownership and suicide rates. So that explains why Finland, out of the five Nordic countries, have the highest suicide rates. In part, that explains it, that there is a high level of gun ownership. So a lot of patterns. Also, there is something we can see if we look at the individual US states. There is something there called the suicide happiness paradox. That means, or the theory is that it might be more difficult to be unhappy in an otherwise happy society because it creates a stronger contrast to your life if you are surrounded by happy people.
Yeah.
So if you look at the...
In terms of the affective dimension?
In terms of the life satisfaction.
Okay.
So if you look at the individual states in the US, if you look at the state's level or state's average happiness level in terms of life satisfaction, the happier states also have a slightly higher suicide rate.
Because of the comparison.
That's the theory.
Right.
So for instance, I think Hawaii is one of the happier states.
Yeah.
It also have one of the highest suicide rates, where New York is in the other end of the spectrum. So and comparisons do seem to pop up a lot when we look at happiness research, when we look at the data, not just for happiness and suicide, but in a lot of areas.
Sure, because how does my narrative and how I see my life merge onto what the culture is telling me it gives value?
And because we're social beings. So when people, for example, look at their income levels, what matters to them is often the relative income instead of the absolute income. So people would rather make, you know, $100 more than the neighbor than make twice as much. So often... There is a classic question that was first posed at Harvard University, I think back in 98, which goes, imagine there's two worlds, and in the first world, you make $50,000 per year, and everybody else makes $25,000. That's the first world. In the second world, you make $100,000, so twice as much as you did in the first world, but everybody else makes $200,000. Which world would you prefer to live in? So one you're making absolutely most and the other one you are making relatively most compared to other people in that world. And around 50% choose the first world to make less in absolute term, but to make more in relative terms. Because what people often care about is not necessarily the ability to consume more, but what they care about is the position in the social hierarchy.
Yeah.
So,
especially hierarchical societies.
Yes, exactly. And also when we talked about loneliness earlier, that's also a pattern. So studies have been done on loneliness and in Denmark, and what they find is that some of the loneliest periods is actually spring and summer, because that's when you witness the rest of Copenhagen being down by the canals, having a nice time, picnic in the park and so on, and you're there by yourself. Whereas in the wintertime, I mean, we're all racing home from work to watch Game of Thrones, right? Nobody sees anything outside.
That was always kind of, you're pointing at something that I've always had trouble with, is that this place branding of Denmark as the happiest country is extremely beneficial in terms of attracting global talent. But when we work with actually trying to design a meaningful and happy life and retaining that talent, there is this disconnect because of this loneliness and not merging with the fact that they're now in the happiest country.
Right.
So I can see that parallel, that because you have this ranking, it creates this expectation of, why am I not matching onto this society? Just like in the spring and summer, why am I not down at the harbor smiling?
Right. And also I think what is a barrier and is an issue is sort of different cultures in terms of organizing your social life. It's what I've experienced, I think, with especially American and Canadian and British colleagues. They're much more spontaneous. than Danes are. Danes have planned their social calendar 2 months in advance, where expats might be more inclined to say, Mike, you want to go out for a beer tonight? And I'll be like, but I mean, I'm meeting Christian, and I mean, I have an opening in October 16th. Would you be interested in that?
Do you think that goes back to what we were saying about Hugo, that it could be, you don't know all the factors?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that. I think the combination of the different style in organizing our social life combined with Danes often being sort of quite bilateral in their relationships. Mm-hmm. So maybe, I mean, let's say I'm meeting Ed tonight, right? We're all friends. And you say, Mike, what are you doing tonight? In other cultures, it might be say, great, join us. You know, you should meet Ed. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
He's here on a romantic visa. he has this podcast. It's great. You guys are going to hit it off. Where in a Danish context, it might be, listen, I'm meeting a friend tonight, so maybe we could do it next week. And I don't invite you to meet Ed because we had this really good conversation last time, and I don't see Ed that often, and he's looking forward to seeing me, and I know he's struggling with work, and we want to get into that, and maybe he's not comfortable with you being there and talking openly about his things. So, I mean, and which is bad, because then you will never meet, and you might be really great friends, and it could be really fun for the three of us to hang out together. So I think Danes should be better at opening up our social circles than we are. I think that is definitely something we should
do. But how can that be incentivized? What do you think could actually...
Danish companies could incentivize
a Dane to want to do that.
I think the first is just being conscious of it. Because I don't think we fully understand the impact it has, that we are as closed as we are.
Hmm. I'm kind of curious from like a meta perspective, why the UN, why was this World Happiness Report commissioned in the first place? What was the mandate?
So it started with a UN resolution the year before, 2011, actually on happiness. So there was a UN resolution that in essence asks all the countries of the world to focus more on happiness and well-being and see what they can do to improve quality of life. And there's a lot of governments and countries now actually doing that. So lately we've had New Zealand decide that they are doing now a well-being budget. So political decisions and bids for the government budget should come with an assessment on how is this going to impact well-being in New Zealand. David Cameron, famously in the UK, he also said, well, I mean, one thing is whether we get richer, another thing is whether we get happier. And that echoes Robert Kennedy's thoughts back in 67, 68, I believe it was, talking about that the GDP measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. And that sentiment is growing these years, that I think people are challenging how we measure progress as societies. We've been looking at, are we getting richer? And we are recognizing that, yes, we have gotten richer as societies, as people, without necessarily getting happier. And that we as countries and as people have failed to convert the wealth we have into well-being. So there's a lot happening with governments and well-being measures. Famously, it's also Bhutan that have taken lead in this. So Bhutan, small country, Eastern Himalayas. Since the beginning of the 70s, they have navigated with something they call gross national happiness. So instead of gross national product, they look at
we had Helen Russell on a while ago.
Yes.
She was talking about the same.
So they took lead in this, and it was also actually Bhutan that put happiness on the agenda for the UN.
Do you think that the report itself and the data being gathered, is there going to be a multi-dimensional report looking at the three dimensions in one index?
So the first...
Is that possible?
It is possible. I mean, I think you should have a dashboard of how people are feeling and how their lives are going. I think the life satisfaction is a very good metric. But I think it's important to look at other things as well. Like when you look at the economy or when you're driving your car, you also look at hopefully the speed and sort of oil in the engine and so on. So I think we need a dashboard with several indicators. I'm also fine with still looking at productivity and looking at the GDP, but I also want to look at other things. Yeah. But the first World Happiness Report actually included both the first dimension, so life satisfaction, and the affective dimension. So it's those dimensions that is mostly being used. The third dimension is the eudaimonic, the sense of purpose, is being used to a lesser extent.
Which is interesting because more and more the generations coming into the work market, that's what they're looking for, is
right.
purpose.
Yeah. But I think it's also important to say, from a scientific point of view, what we really like is the longitudinal studies. It's following people over time.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we take the Gallup data, then we would see, okay, people who are married are on average happier. But does that mean we get happy from marriage? Or is it the other way around, that people who are happy, optimistic, have an easier time attracting a partner? But when we follow people over time, and they've done that in the UK, the British Household Panel survey, and in Germany, also followed large groups of people, tens of thousands of people, over decades, then you can see, because you follow so many people over such a long time, some people do get married. And then you can see, because you ask them about happiness every year, how happy they are in different dimensions, then you can see, okay, what happens when people get married? And yes, there is an increase in happiness when people get married, actually a little bit before, because you meet that certain someone.
And,
yeah. And then we sort of adapt to marriage. There is sort of a reduction, but there's still a long-term effect
risky
from marriage.
Risky behaviors go.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do. But
men
then
our wives are listening,
stuff.
So carefully.
But then when you rewind and go back, who were those people who got married later on? You can also see that actually the other thing was true, that yes, happier people have a bigger chance of getting married in the decades to come.
And is there a place of looking at how we teach? Do we and other examples of teaching lower expectations or removing expectations and removing comparison to others? Because I know that I've got no idea what anybody else earns, especially by looking at what car they're driving, what house they live in, and where they went on holiday. We're notoriously bad at those things. But I also know plenty of people who try and keep up with the Joneses and find themselves in huge sums of debt.
Right.
After 10 years of keeping up with a neighbor they don't even like.
Yeah, yeah. Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
And what drove part of the financial crisis,
sure.
right? And
yeah.
unfortunately, I mean, we are perhaps a bit wired for that.
Sure.
And I'm not sure, maybe it's an American saying that a happy man is a man that makes $100 more than his wife, sister's husband, or something like that.
I've heard something like that.
But I think, I mean, you asked about, is there teaching, is there something we can do to change that? And I think there is, at least, there have been studies where, I think this is Mexico and Chile and Bhutan, where they've done a massive study with more than 100,000 students, introducing a happiness curriculum. So instead of learning just math and English and science, you actually teach kids about life and how to handle that. You teach resilience and empathy and other things. And shown positive results, both in terms of actually academic performance and well-being. So if people are interested in that, they should check out the researcher called Alejandro Adler, who's sort of leading the field in happiness and education.
But it is almost that return to the classical Greek sense of the academy in terms of perfecting the human nature and what does happiness actually consist of, that Aristotelian idea of eudaimonia.
Yeah.
And actually trying to incorporate that back into, okay, are we teaching just so you're competent in the STEM fields, or do we actually want to create a path for well-being through Denos' reformation?
Right.
There's a TED talk, isn't there, of a lady who was a dance teacher and then spent some time in Cuba and found that because marketing is illegal, in Cuba. There are no billboards, etc. There's no body image. There's no negative body image. Everybody is very provocative and attractive, and regardless of body shape, doesn't, you know, try and cover themselves up or hide themselves. Is there something to be said for countries not being allowed to sell certain things or sell certain things in certain ways?
I can't think of any studies that have looked into that. But I think it's natural, or it makes good sense if you are exposed to some ideals that none of us can live up to. Mm-hmm. We compare ourselves to our peers and our surroundings, and that would create a stronger contrast. It's also one of the theories in surrounding social media, that we are bombarded with curated perfect lives of everybody else. I don't know of any studies that show that, but I think it would make...
Anytime you are just in this moment, you know, changing the affective state can actually change the life satisfaction over time. I think it would be interesting if the educational sector started looking at that
right
as part of this equation.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm mindful of our time, and I think it's been a fascinating discussion, and we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and wrap up the podcast with some quick-fire questions.
With our quick fire round, questions will be quick fire. The answers certainly don't need to be. Do you have any habits, routines, or rituals that you do every day to keep yourself mentally, physically? I'm going to say happy rather than sharp, but you can take either.
I think the best universal tip in terms of boosting happiness and well-being is actually something from ABC. So ABC for mental well-being.
Always be closing.
It's actually no. I think that I would recommend against that. So it's actually doing something active, doing something together with other people, and doing something meaningful. I think that's the best universal tip we can give for boosting mood on a daily basis.
And
my everyday is very different. So I spend about 100 days per year traveling. And the rest in Copenhagen. So my life in Copenhagen is very different from what I do when I'm abroad. But what I always try to do is actually I learn language on Duolingo. It's a mental break, but also sort of a mental exercise.
Yeah.
So I've gone through Spanish. I speak Spanish as a third language, though really badly. I had a girlfriend at one point from Mexico. She hated when I spoke Spanish because she thought I sounded like Speedy Gonzalez. Mira un edificio, which is not what you want.
No más.
So we kept it in English. But now I've started learning Chinese actually because I think it's really fun. The characters and quite poetic actually also in the construction of it. So the sign for good, which is how. Is the sign for women, a woman and child. And the sign for landscape is the combination of the sign for river and mountain. So it's really fun and very different from Spanish and so the other languages I've used to. So I try to do that on a daily basis.
And being a polyglot will help with memory retention, warding off dementia,
yes,
and executive function. Yeah,
exactly.
Cognitively, so it's a lot of benefits.
Yeah.
Are there any one-off experiences or events you would attribute with changing you fundamentally?
The reason, or one of the reasons why I started the Happiness Research Institute now 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, is perhaps one of those. So at the time, I was working for another think tank in Copenhagen, and I was director for a division on sustainability, but noticed what we were talking about before with UN, with Cameron in the UK, different governments started to measure happiness. And I thought there should be somebody in Denmark pooling this knowledge. There should be somebody creating a think tank, a knowledge center on well-being, on happiness. Somebody should understand and explore why does Denmark do well, and Nordic countries do well in these happiness rankings. And then I thought, maybe I should do that. But this was 2012, so just in the wake of the financial crisis. And I also thought, it could be a little bit risky to start something as crazy as a happiness research institute. And I had a steady, well-paying job. But then what happened was, on the personal side, was one of my colleagues who was my mentor at the company, who I really looked up to in terms of him professionally and privately, got very ill and died when he was 49. And my own mother had also died when she was 49 from cancer as well. And at that time, in 2012, I was 34. So I started to say, okay, or to think, you have 15 years left until you're 49. And what are you going to spend those years doing? I mean, you can continue with this job, which is fine, but you're not super passionate about it anymore. Or you can start this thing called the Happiness Research Institute, which I just felt could be really fun and really interesting to do. So after that thought occurred, it took, I think, 2 months. And then I quit my old job. I hadn't spoken to a single client or a single partner, and started out with what I thought was a good idea and a bad laptop. So I think, I mean, you know,
good for you.
I think, you know, those sort of memento mori moments, you know, where we remember that at one point, we're going to run out of time. I think those can be useful in terms of making tough decisions.
And is that something that you reflect on frequently?
So recently, yes, actually. So last year I turned 40. And statistically speaking, in Denmark, men live till we are 80. And that means...
Halfway.
That actually meant that I started to reflect on, looking back on my first half, my first 40 years, what were my happiest moments, and you know, what are my happiest memories today, and how can I use that going forward in the next 40 years, the second half, to create great memories to look back at when I'm 80. And that was actually the sort of inspiration from my upcoming book, The Art of Making Memories. So that was, yeah, it's something I reflect on, sort of not on a daily basis, but I think I'm just aware of my, not necessarily expiration date, but my mortality.
Yeah. As Ernest Becker says, the physicality of death will destroy us, but the idea of death can liberate us.
Yeah.
To create and really dare. I can hear you did that.
The editor of Wired magazine, Kevin Kelly, has researched his predicted death date and has a countdown timer on his computer.
Okay.
That's how you take it to the next level.
Will he be disappointed if he sees the time so far, but he hasn't?
Or if he's got a bad laptop.
Oh, my calculation.
You're invited to a dinner party, and you can take two guests from history, alive or dead. Who do you take, and why?
My mom. Obviously, I mean, she died when I was relatively young, and I think it would be really fun and great to sort of meet her as an adult. And with her, a lot of sort of family anecdotes and stories also got lost. So definitely her. I mean, one of my heroes right now is John Halliwell, who is, I think he's 81. He's one of the World Happiness Report editors. But he's also just the kindest man you'll ever meet. And everybody who meets him, he's just, you know, he has a great effect on people. So he's personally an inspiration. He's just a great guy, and his wife is wonderful as well. So I've enjoyed spending time with them. Last year, we went to their summer cabin in on Hornby Island, 6 hours and three ferries from Vancouver. Three ferries. But yeah, he's a great guy. He's a great source of inspiration. So bring him along as well.
Fantastic. Did you have a teacher or mentor growing up that had a major influence on you?
I mean, I've been surrounded by a lot of good people. My dad has actually also some influence in terms of me deciding to create the Happiness Research Institute, because he always preached that I should do something I loved and not care about how much money I made. He was really supportive when I told him that I had quit and wanted to do to create a think tank on happiness. So I think his sort of mentoring me into thinking about doing something I'm passionate about. I remember him saying that, you know, be sure you do something you love because you're going to spend so many hours doing it. I think that voice have also had a great influence in my career decisions.
Do you have a book or books of most influenced you?
If we are talking non-fiction, I think actually Freakonomics, which came out, this must be almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Where
wow. Amazing.
You're getting old.
Yeah. Sorry to bring you this news, but yeah. So for those of you that don't know Freakonomics, it is an economist and a journalist combined writing about findings. So basically using economic methods to look at the world. And that book really inspired me, and in part actually also is one of the reasons why I do what I do today, because we also apply a lot of economic methods in happiness research. We're trying to look for patterns. We're trying to look at not just what is the correlations, but what are the causations, which is one of the key pillars of economics. So that got me into using, I think, science and economic methods to look at the world and understand the world.
Mike, I'm mindful of the time, and we want to wrap up the podcast today with one final question. And as the king of Hugendlücke, it's curious to hear your answer. But what do you think someone like you can teach Denmark, and what do you think Denmark can teach the rest of the world?
What I can teach Denmark? I hope that Denmark will take inspiration from the UK and from New Zealand and from Scotland, who's also one of the countries that are embracing happiness research and prioritizing well-being and putting that at the core of public policy. I would love a similar survey to the one there is in the UK. I would love a national well-being budget in Denmark. I'm not sure I can learn that to Denmark, actually, or teach Denmark that, but maybe I could be the intermediary. And then what can Denmark learn?
Teach the
rest of the world. I think Denmark, combined with the other Nordic countries, are relatively good at creating good conditions for good lives. I think the Nordic welfare model is quite good at delivering quality of life. I think the investments in infrastructure, where, you know, pedestrians and cyclists are put at the core and treated like kings and queens of the road, I think cities around the world could take inspiration from that. So I think in terms of policy infrastructure, I think there is some inspiration to be found there. But of course, no country is perfect.
Excellent. Well, before we go, is there anything you would like to promote or tell our audience where they could find you and your works?
So, I mean, if people are interested in our work, we have a website.
How modern.
It's on this thing called the internet. If people are interested in downloading our reports, that's where they
should. Should they Google website?
What is this Google you talk of? They can also follow me on social media, on Instagram and Facebook and so on. And I post about our latest findings and my latest books there.
And you have a book coming out?
Yeah, so it's coming out. The new book is coming out on September 19th in the UK, and it's being translated to, I think, at least 20 languages, but I'm not sure when those are coming out. But yeah, that's The Art of Making Memories.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to talk about that next time. Yeah. A true pleasure, Mike.
Likewise. Thank you. I enjoyed that.
Thanks for coming by the podcast. And to our audience, don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. Rate, review, subscribe, whatever you can do to help our podcast continue to grow. And until next time, see you on the GDP.
Are you getting the most out of your time in Denmark? Pick up your printed copy of the English language newspaper Copenhagen Post today to access relevant news and event information guaranteed to enhance your working and family life.